Okay, this is Ken Samuelson, and I'm here with Mr. Jim Davidson. Today is March the 28th, and my address is 545 Southwood Drive in Eden, North Carolina. And my telephone number is 336-623-7787. And Mr. Davidson, could you give your name, date and place of birth, and where you live, and phone number?
I was born in Randolph County, April 22nd, 1923.
And where do you live now?
I live at 1845 Indian Trail, Eden, North Carolina.
Any phone number?
And my phone number is 336-623-3667.
And what town was it where you were born?
In Asheboro, North Carolina.
In Asheboro, okay. And did you grow up in Asheboro?
Yeah, grew up in Asheboro. And
how long did you live in Asheboro?
I lived in Asheboro.
Till you entered the service, or?
Well, I entered the service and came back out of service and worked for a while in Asheboro, and then I came to Eden.
Okay.
And then at Leakesville Springs,
right,
at that time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you went to high school then in Asheboro?
In Asheboro and Farmer.
Okay. So you graduated from high school when, about 1940 or so?
41.
41. Graduated in 1941.
41.
Okay. So you were, I guess, 18 years old then when you graduated, or
yeah,
something like that?
17, 18.
Okay, so you graduated in 1941 prior to Pearl Harbor, I take it?
Yeah.
Mid-June or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, okay, so what did you do right after you graduated?
Well,
did you
I
work
went
there.
I started to work at McCrary Hosier Mill.
Okay.
And, I ran a full-fashioned knitting machine at McCrary Hosier Mill for up until I went into service.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I came back out of service, I worked for a while in the mill then. And then I got tired of that and I wanted to do something else. So my sister was working for Philip was in the loan business uptown, and so one day he called me and asked me if I thought that I would like the loan business.
Yeah.
And I said,
okay,
I don't have any idea. I said, I don't know anything about the loan business. And I says, he said, well, you don't have to know anything. He said, I'll teach you everything.
Okay. Well, anyway, we'll get back to that.
Okay.
Okay. You graduated from high school then and worked in the hosiery mill then. And now, what did you know about, do you have any recollection of what you knew about what was happening in Europe or around the world? Did you have any information as a young man as to what, you know, we were about to go to war or anything of that kind, or did you?
Well, I knew that we were about to go to war, but I didn't know a whole lot about it until Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. Okay, so you were working at the mill then when Pearl Harbor occurred
on
Sunday, December 7th?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did you recall how you learned about Pearl Harbor? Were you listening to the radio?
Well, we were listening to the radio going to work one morning.
On Sunday morning?
My daddy and my brother, they worked together. And they had a little job that they had to finish up, and we were going over there and finished that up, and wasn't going to take me just a little while, and so we went over there, and we heard about it when we were going over there.
On the radio, on your car radio, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Is that the idea? Ooh, okay. What did Pearl Harbor mean to you? Anything, or just a name or a place? You
kind of put some fear in you, you know. I mean, you wondered what was going to really happen.
Right.
We figured that we'd get into the war really heavy. Or they might even attack us.
Sure.
We didn't know at that time.
So December 7th occurred then, and when did you actually enter the service?
Well,
just roughly, you know. Was it shortly after that, or did you, and how did you join, or were you drafted?
No, I was drafted.
You were drafted.
Yeah, I would think that...
Just roughly, you know.
I think it's probably a year later.
Oh, a year later, okay, so...
That would have been, what, 43?
No, December of 42 then would have been. That's a year later, you know, 41, and then would have been that long?
I think that it was around 43.
Okay, so a little over a year then.
Yeah, 43.
So did you continue 45. Working in the mill then during that time?
Yeah, up until I was drafted.
Uh-huh. Did you have any idea that you might want to join, or many of your friends joining?
Well, they were being drafted.
Uh-huh. So you figured...
There was a few people that joined, but most of them was being drafted.
Uh-huh. So your idea was that you'd wait until you got drafted,
yeah,
I guess?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So when, roughly in early 43 then, you got drafted? Is
uh-huh.
that the idea?
In 43.
So when you were drafted then, January the 8th, 1943?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
That was just about 1 year later then.
Mm-hmm. Went to Camp Cross, South Carolina.
How did you get a letter? How did you learn about that you were drafted?
Oh, we got a letter. Yeah, got a letter.
What did you think?
Send report.
What did you think when you got that letter?
Oh, man alive. It was disturbing.
It was disturbing.
There was about three or four of us boys that run around together, and we took it pretty good.
Uh-huh.
But we were glad that we were going to all be together, you know.
Oh, okay.
So when we went down to Camp Croft.
And where did you go? Where did they send you, to Greensboro or someplace? Or
no, right there in Ashboro. Put us on the bus right there in Ashboro and sent us on to Camp Croft, South Carolina.
Oh, okay. So you went right from Ashboro to Camp Croft.
And...
Now, what happened when you were on a bus, I take it, or what?
Yeah, we rode down on the bus, a whole bus load of us.
Bus load of you.
Yeah.
And when you got to Camp Croft, how were you greeted when you got to the camp?
Well,
there?
Kind of like a bunch of cattle. We line up.
Okay.
So we all lined up. And I think... The first thing we did, and I think that it was late in the afternoon,
uh-huh.
and I think the first thing we did, we went to the mess hall and eat.
Uh-huh.
And then they started processing us. And they did some until maybe 9 o'clock that night, and then the next morning they started to process the rest of us. Giving us shots and all that kind of stuff.
You know. So you got shots, and then they give you a uniform at that time?
I think you got the uniform probably after you got completely processed.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. They
and you got a lot of shots?
Yeah, got a lot of shots. And
well, then did you start basic training? Or what did you do?
Well, we kind of got organized for several days, and then we were assigned to different outfits and this and that and the other. And so we...
You in barracks, I take it, Don?
Uh-huh. We were in barracks, and they started mobilizing different units.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sending us out to this one and that one and the other. One of my friends, he went in the infantry. One of them went someplace else, and I went into the artillery, and
so they started breaking you down almost immediately
and forming a new outfit.
Uh-huh.
385th Artillery.
Okay. And you say your friends were in that group with you, or
yeah, they were in that group with me, but they weren't assigned to the same outfit that I was.
Uh-huh.
They were assigned to different outfits, and some of them went to Texas, some of them went to Quantico, Virginia, and different places.
Did they split you up almost immediately?
Yeah, yeah, they split us up. They started to sign us in the next few days.
Okay, so you were split up as your group then went hither and yon pretty quickly,
right.
Huh?
Yeah.
And then where did you stay there?
I stayed there and went into this outfit here.
Uh-huh. Okay, that was the artillery.
Uh-huh, 385th.
Okay, now, what kind of basic training did they give you at that time? Did you get much?
Well, yeah, oh, we got right much.
How long did it, how many months or weeks or whatever?
I think that we stayed down there and collected up our rifles and all that kind of stuff, and then the whole outfit was shipped out to Camp Edwards, Massachusetts.
Oh, so you didn't stay there very long then?
No, you know, this was just a
couple days or so.
What is it, reception center, induction center?
Induction center. Okay.
And we didn't stay there very long at all. When we got all the group together, we got on a train and we went to Camp Edwards, Massachusetts.
And what was that train ride like? Were you jammed in there like cattle again, or was it pretty
bad? I mean, some of the guys had to sleep out into the aisles, you know, and.
Oh.
It took us a couple of days to get up there, three days anyway.
Yeah.
And of course they slept on the train.
What kind of food did you have when you were on that train? Did they feed you okay, or did you?
Well, just makeshift stuff, you know, not very good.
Just something to keep you
going until you got there.
Yeah.
But after we got to Camp Edwards now, Camp Edwards was a real nice outfit. I mean, it was a nice camp.
Now, did you take basic training there?
Yep, took basic training there.
But you were already in your artillery group.
Yeah.
Was it one of your artillery guys that were taking you under their wing and training you?
Yeah, well, this was a brand new outfit.
Uh-huh.
And they had the cadre to, you know, the cadres, whenever they come in, they're already trained. They're ready to take control of each unit, battery and.
So did you go into what you typically think as basic training? You know, shooting your rifle, marching, physical education, or physical conditioning, and this kind of thing.
Yes, sir.
You did all that?
Yes, sir. And
did they stress that for a certain period of time before you kind of got active with your group?
Yeah, we did that. We marched and we got our uniforms ship shape, you know, and we stood inspections.
A lot of inspections.
And had to get those rifles cleaned. Of course, we went on the rifle range. And by the way, I believe I got marked.
Marksman, huh? Good for you.
I think it's on the discharge or somewhere.
That's a good thing for a soldier to be.
Oh, well, at that time, you know, we thought it was a stuff. Yeah. But it was.
So you were actually with your group that you were going to be with. You were being trained by your group,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, that's exactly.
It's different from going to basic training and then being shipped out to a group.
No, we were formed down there and shipped on up to. We thought we were going to go to Virginia.
Camp Lee or something.
Camp Lee. Uh-huh. That's where we thought we was going to go, but
they needed soldiers badly at that time,
yeah,
didn't they?
And then there was a section of the train that did stop off at Fort Lee, Virginia.
Uh-huh.
But we kept on going, and of course we didn't know where we were going. They didn't tell us. And we didn't know where we were going, New York or where. But anyway, we landed up in Camp Edwards.
Did your basic training last, your basic training last several weeks or a month or so?
What is it, 9 weeks?
9 weeks.
Yeah, I think it was 9 weeks of basic training you had at Camp Edwards.
Okay.
And
these were men from your...
From our outfit.
From your group that were training you.
From our outfit. It was kind of in the fall when we went up there. It seems like it was in the fall. But you talk about cold. Now, it got cold up there. Snow up about like this, about knee deep. And, of course, they would send us out on these bivouacs. You know?
Yeah, right.
And we were, the
so
red,
it would have been
the red was fighting the blue, and the blue was fighting the red, you know. And
what was the purpose of all that? Get you
basic
trained?
Basic training. Get you tough.
get you tough and get you trained. Do you feel like you were put into pretty good physical condition then?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. But I was out on bivouac, and the snow was real deep, and I had abscess tooth, and it was swelled up about like that, about like a orange.
Yeah.
And so I was out on bivouac probably for 2 weeks and or maybe week and a half, and then that thing swelled up, and then I had to go to the hospital. Well, by that time, well, our basic training was getting to the place where it was about over with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember the old sergeant came up there one day and says, he called me Dave. And Dave says, you got to get out of here. Says, all of our ratings is going to be given out here in the next little while. And says, you got to get out of here. So he says, I've got you up for a rating, but he says, if you don't get out, well, we're going to have to give it to somebody else. So I said, well, I want to get out now if I can, but the doctor wouldn't let me because my jaw was swelled up so. And they put cold packs on it night and day. Put hot packs on it to start with. And then they put cold packs on it. It wouldn't go down. So Colonel Eccles, he was the doctor. So he told me, he said, I hate to cut you, but says I'm going to have to do it. I said, well, we've got to do something. I said, I got to get out of this place. And so he started cutting on me one morning. He says, I'd rather cut myself than cut you. I said, well, it's got to be done. I said, you're not swelled up, and I am. But he lanced it, and it went on down, and that's I got out. I got out, but battalion was already getting ready to ship out. We're going back south. So we were all shipped out back down to...
So you did catch up with your group then?
Oh, yeah, I shipped out with them, but the rating has already been given out and everything, so I was just a lost sheep then. But anyway, we went down to Camp Rooker, Alabama.
Camp Rooker?
Camp Rooker, Alabama.
Rooker.
That's close to Eglin Field, Florida.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's another big train ride with a lot of people on the train.
Yeah, it was a lot of tanks and mechanized stuff, all that camp.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, all mechanized and red clay. Man alive, nothing but red clay. And I can't remember the little old town that's right outside the gate of Camp Rooker. But anyway, we did basic training. We did more basic training down there, and went out around Eglin Field and set up and all that kind of stuff.
Would this have been about like summer of 43 then, or what? You went in January, so it sounds like it'd been close.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
Sometimes.
And then after we stayed there for a while, they shipped us from there to Tennessee Maneuvers. So we spent 3 weeks in Cookeville, Tennessee.
Oh, yeah.
And we were bivouacked out in the woods and all mm-hmm. around the fields and stuff like that.
Was this War Games again?
Yeah. And
Blue versus... Green,
yeah,
or whatever.
And then we, from there, we went to
it's an unnamed camp for the moment.
Yeah,
but anyway,
for the moment. But we went through some rigid training down there. I mean, in those swamps down there in Georgia. And
what was your day like down there?
Well, our days was fast, and our nights was too. And we were out on bivouac one night, and no lights. Nobody had no lights. And we had convoy going here and going there, and there were this one old boy. He drove his truck off in the lake down there.
Into the lake?
Into the lake. And I think that they had to call in somebody the next day and pull that thing out. But he couldn't see. Poor boy started across the dam, and he just couldn't see.
Went right in the lake.
Yeah, it was.
So he lose his truck or Jeep,
well,
or whatever?
Well, lost it, but they pulled it out, got it back.
It wasn't that deep where it
no,
kept
wasn't that,
going.
No, it wasn't that deep, but he run off in the lake. But from there.
So did you get up like at 5 o'clock in the morning or something?
Oh,
or were
man,
you
yeah.
24 hours a day?
Yes, sirree. We had some bad training.
Pretty much around the clock?
Yeah, it was train there. And then from there.
What were they training you for at that time?
Well, they were training us for what we were supposed
just
to do.
Combat?
The artillery, yes, sirree.
Okay.
And from there, we went on to Camp Shanks, New York. Camp Shanks, New York, got on the boat and went to Glasgow, Scotland. That's where we landed.
On your training, Jimmy, when you were like at Don Savannah and so forth, were you firing those guns every day too?
No, we didn't fire the guns at that time.
You did not.
When we fired the guns, we had to go to the firing range.
Okay.
And we would go to the firing range and set up, you know, a whole row of them.
Right.
Guns. And
did you do that in Savannah too, or where did you do
well,
that?
Well, yeah, we had a firing range out there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and we had a firing range in Camp Brooker, Alabama.
Uh-huh. And what were your duties on the firing range then?
Well,
what did you do?
A lot of times I would help the guys place the guns, and like I say, sometimes I would be driving the colonel, or be driving the captain, or the battery commander.
So you were kind of your especially was as a driver at that point.
Yeah, and sometimes I'd be assigned to a battery.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed here on my discharge that they've got me assigned to battery B on my discharge, but I was really headquarters battery.
Uh-huh.
That was my whole
up with all the brass.
Well, where the supplies was and the rations and
uh-huh.
and administrative to,
yeah.
you know.
Uh-huh.
But I was attached to headquarters, but I noticed here on my discharge they got it battery B.
Mm-hmm.
But I never was attached to battery B. In fact, I never was attached to any battery.
You're just headquarters.
I was headquarters.
Uh-huh. Okay, so then you went back up north, you said?
Yeah, to Camp Shanks, New York.
Camp Shanks, okay, and then?
Yeah, on overseas.
And what kind of vessel were you on? No big Queen Mary or something? Or
no, it wasn't the Acritania.
Oh, okay. That was a private vessel that had been converted?
Yeah.
To a troop ship?
Yep. That's right. It was a huge ship. I think it was about 5,000.
An ocean liner, basically,
yeah.
That was converted to
and converted to a troop carrier.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
And what were conditions like aboard that vessel?
Oh, terrible, terrible.
What made them terrible?
Oh well, you know, everybody was sick and everybody was vomiting. You couldn't even go eat a meal, you know. It's just, oh, terrible.
And that was terrible. What, a couple of weeks aboard that vessel? How long did it take you to get
About
maybe
almost 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
Yeah, almost 2 weeks. And as I say, we landed in Glasgow, Scotland.
Now, when you went across, you were part of a convoy, I take it. Were you part of
that? No, we were single. We were just out in the ocean by ourselves.
You were?
Yes, sir.
No kidding.
Nobody.
Did you get a little nervous about the German submarine?
Oh, man, we sure did. In fact, we thought they were going to get us one night.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They had sighted one, and, oh, they had us all scared to death.
Did you have any guns aboard that vessel?
No.
No guns?
No.
You know, the Queen Mary, they did loan some guns on, they put some guns on there.
I don't believe there was any guns on that
uh-huh.
ship. I never
so you were really unprotected.
Oh, we were just as unprotected as you could be.
For 2 weeks.
We were scared to death. We, you know, when you go to bed at night, you didn't know where you're gonna wind up for the morning.
Yeah.
And of course they zigzagged and did this and that and the other. A lot of times.
Yeah, I'm surprised you went totally unprotected over there.
Yeah, no protection at all. Not at all.
That's something.
Of course, I guess, you know, they had radar.
Yeah.
And stuff like
sonar, that. Sonar, whatever.
Yeah.
To tell if something was out there, but you didn't have any depth bombs, depth charges or anything like that.
We were just sitting duck.
Yeah, that's all. Just a sitting duck. So you went to Glasgow.
Yeah, Glasgow, Scotland.
And what was your reception like there? Where did you come in and they berthed the ship and then they got you all off? And
yeah.
What happened to you?
We got on a train and I don't remember. It seems like to me that we did get something to eat. But I think everybody was so sick they couldn't eat. So anyway, they put us on a troop train, and we went from Glasgow, Scotland. And the best I remember, we went down through Hanover and some of the larger towns. And we went down to a little town called Leominster, England.
Leominster, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Leominster, England.
Mm-hmm.
There was Leominster and Thatcham, Newbury, Reading, yeah, in that area.
Now, how far was that from London, for example?
I would think it was probably 40 miles, 50.
Okay, so it's fairly close. Huh?
Yeah, fairly close.
Okay, to the big city.
But
what were your duties there? What did you do there?
Well, we set up camp. When we had tents, you know, set up tents in these areas, and
so this would have been getting into fall of 43, I guess, or later 43.
Yeah, and of course we were trying to get our equipment ready, our supplies, and all that kind of stuff. We'd be working on it, and at that time I was messenger boy, I guess, is what you'd call it. But anyway, I was going from place to place, getting supplies and equipment for, you know, the guns and whatever, radar, whatever we needed, you know.
You stayed in tents at that time. They had a big tent city, basically.
And we had these old big pot-bellied stoves in the middle of the tent, you know, and run by dripping oil into the thing, you know. And
how many were in your group there? You must have had a huge number of people.
Huh? Oh, we did. We had a whole battalion. And five batteries, including headquarters battery. Four gun batteries and headquarters battery.
So what did they tell you about, you know, what you were doing, and what did you know about what your plans were for?
Well, we were preparing to go to France. I mean, that was our...
Of course, D-Day was a long way away.
Well, D-Day was a long ways away. We stayed in England for...
Probably what, six?
7 or 8 months.
Yeah, okay.
7 or 8 months, and then...
How did they keep you guys occupied for 7 or 8 months?
Well, we stayed occupied. I was running around all over the whole country just about picking up this and picking up that, and I could get around real easy over there. And
well, you had a Jeep, I guess.
Yeah, and they sent me down to Bournemouth and Land's End. On past, where'd we leave from? Anyway, Bournemouth is down in that area where we left to go over to France.
Mm-hmm.
But I went down to Land's End. They had big supply depots all up and down that whole area. And you'd have to go to this one and have to go to that one.
So you're getting up, so your group or your battalion or whatever was fully supplied, ready to go into action.
Ready to go. Yes, sir. Ready.
Now, did, you know, with guys, you know, just waiting, I know you were a busy person, but how did they keep all the guys active and keep them from making trouble and so forth, you know?
Well, they would work them, and they'd have you know, gun duty and guard duty and
cleaning their guns, I guess.
Yeah,
they were so
cleaning
clean.
Guns day after day after day. And but everybody stayed real busy. We didn't have any slack time.
Really?
No. They kept us on the move. We'd do this, do that, but
what kind of day did you? Now yours was probably a little different from most, I guess. But what time did they get you up in the morning and this kind of thing? Do you recall what your day
was?
Well,
usually you'd have
reveille at
what?
Six
o'clock, and then you would probably fall out with the rest of them and run around for 15, 20 minutes.
Still then, working on physical conditioning,
yeah,
and so forth?
Yeah, and they'd keep you busy, and of course you'd go eat, and then you'd go to your regular duties, what mm-hmm. you need to do. But
what did you know about the war at this time? Did you feel like you were pretty well informed on what was going on and so forth?
Well, we knew that we were going to have D-Day, and yeah. we were ready. We wanted to go.
Yeah.
Ready. We didn't want to sit around, you know.
You wanted to get over
with. We wanted to get it over with. And
did you have any ideas to when you would, you know, compared, for example, to the initial landings, when you would actually go, or did you think you might be there on day one, or did you know that you'd be there, say, a week later?
No, after D-Day, we went into this staging area.
Uh-huh.
And when we went into this staging area, just as soon as there were ships available or whatever, then we're going to go. So we stayed in that staging area and for several days with all of our equipment and everything. And so,
of course, they didn't need artillery right away because they had to get on the beaches. Yeah.
Well, that's true.
That's
so,
why you guys were came in later.
Yeah, that's why we came in later.
Because the naval vessels were doing
jobs,
so the artillery job.
Yeah, all right. But see, we had we were anti aircraft really.
Oh, you were anti.
And you see, we had 90s and we had 40s and uh-huh. and all that, and of course those 90s was. Good long distance,
did you have any 105s or 155s?
We didn't have 105s at that time.
Uh-huh.
We had some 105s after we got on up into.
So you were primarily anti-aircraft then.
Yeah, primarily our outfit was anti-aircraft, but we were shifted around. In fact, when we got on up into Germany, we were infantry for three or four weeks,
uh-huh.
month, something like that.
That's what they needed.
Yeah, that's what they had to have. And then after that, they would just break us up and say, we need so-and-so here. We'd have to go.
Yeah.
And in fact, we got on up into Germany or France, really, and they had to have every battalion had to have so many trucks to put on the Red Ball Highway. hauling supplies and yeah. ammunition and stuff like that up to the front.
Right.
We stayed on that Red Ball Highway for about, I don't know, three or four weeks, something like that.
Okay, well, let's go back then to you're kind of waiting then until your unit has to land in France.
Yeah,
and right. you say you kept you real busy. And okay, so then you, what did you know about the day that D-Day occurred? Did you have any information flown to your group that you know this is about to happen, or were you kind of in the dark?
No, we knew that it was, we knew that it had to happen right away. I mean,
but you didn't
everybody,
know when. No,
you we didn't know when. What day, we didn't know when yeah. or anything, but we knew that the buildup was terrific. I mean, everybody was ready, and the buildup was getting to the place where we knew that something's got to happen. So we got on the boats down there at Southampton.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we landed. See, there's Southampton, Bournemouth, and then Land's End on up and down there, but we got on at Southampton.
Okay. So how did you get your information? How does that pass down to you and so forth? Were you a big meeting called among your battalion, or how? You have a small
oh, yeah.
say, okay, well, guys, we got to go tomorrow or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. The colonel, he stayed informed. You know, the general was over the colonel and
yeah.
come right on down the line. And of course,
so how did you get your orders then to you needed to be ready to go? Did your sergeant tell you that or?
Oh no, they.
You have a big meeting with
the battalion. The battalion commander told us. I mean, he put us all in a group, you know, and said, "Well, we're going," and of course, everybody start telling everybody that how to do and what to do and this uh-huh. that and the other. And then when we got on the LSTs, the things, the landing craft. Well,
what did they tell you, Jim, about? About what they wanted you, what was your specific responsibility that you had that they told you you had to do when you got on that LST and got off? What did you have to do?
My responsibility that time, I was hooked up to, I believe it was either 40 millimeter or 90 millimeter, I'm not sure which. You get that gun on the beach.
Get it on the beach.
Get it okay. on the beach. And
this gun was located on this landing craft?
Located on the landing craft and hooked up, ready to go.
How
ready
heavy
to pull
was
right
it?
Off.
How heavy was it?
Oh, man.
I mean, how many men did it take to handle it?
On the 40s, it took... four men.
Okay, so you were one of four men that had to...
Yeah, and on the 90s, it took four men. And so we...
Now, was this a weapon on a trailer of some kind?
No, it was just on... the 40s was on four wheels, and the 90s was on two wheels.
Okay.
And they were pulling right behind them.
So it's a
vehicle.
Kind of like a trail on a trailer that was pulled behind a truck or whatever, huh?
And the best that I remember, we had to be pulled up through there. I think that they had bulldozers or something pulling us over there. I think we had to be hooked up to a cable.
What, do you know which beach you landed on?
Uh-huh, Utah.
You landed on Utah Beach.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
There was Utah.
Omaha. Juneau.
And Juneau.
Gold.
And they wouldn't down Cherbourg. They didn't go down as far as Cherbourg because
right.
all the, they had mines all out into
yeah.
the water out down there, so you couldn't go in down
right.
there. So we went in Utah.
You went on Utah Beach. Okay.
Yeah.
And the LST, you're on an LST?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
LST, you know, that
one
I think that's what you call them, LSTs.
It was a, how many, they have the landing craft, the LC.
Yeah, that's the landing craft.
Uh-huh. Is that what you run, a
uh-huh,
landing craft?
Yeah.
As opposed to an
that
LST?
That gate fell down, you know, and you,
yeah,
you'd go out.
What did you think when that gate went down?
Man alive, I don't know. You talk about, of course, you could hear the gun. You could hear the
guns going off.
Sound like firecrackers everywhere.
Anybody get sick when they went over the side and got in that landing craft? Did you go down a rope ladder down to it?
No. We went pull right off. I mean, he shoved that thing right up on the beach. We pulled right off.
No, excuse me. I mean, were you on a mothership of some kind, or did that landing craft?
No, that landing craft carried us all the way over.
All the way across.
Yeah,
okay.
All the way
so
across.
It was loaded and took you all the way across.
Yeah, all the way across. Uh-huh.
Now, that was a pretty choppy ride, I bet.
Well, it was. And we couldn't land that night. We had to wait till morning to land.
And this would have been about 2 weeks after, you say, 10, 12 days after D-Day?
Maybe 14.
14, okay. About the 20th of
yeah,
June.
Yeah. It
roughly.
Was, I don't remember just
yeah,
exactly how
right,
many days, but it was, I'd say it was probably 14 or...
So your craft then went all the way across the channel.
Yeah, went all the way across the channel.
Very rough ride, I'm sure.
Very rough ride.
And then when you got to Utah Beach, the door went down.
Yeah.
And what did you do?
Well, we tried it. We got out of there. We pulled that thing out of there.
Now, was there a truck on that?
Yeah.
Truck. Okay, you had a truck, so you started, somebody, you had a driver, started that engine up?
Yes, sir. Pulled right out on that beach and went right straight up that hill.
Now, how many people were on this craft that you were on, this watercraft, when you went across there, roughly?
I'd say that there was probably one battery. And I don't remember exactly how many people's in a battery.
Mm-hmm. About 15, 20 men?
Oh, no, there was...
More than that? It might have been an LST, then you...
It was... I'd say there's probably 35.
Uh-huh.
35 or 40 people.
Okay.
And...
So you started, and you had how many trucks did you have aboard that then?
I don't remember exactly, but it seems like to me that there was two or three trucks,
and each one had a 40 or
maybe there was four. I don't know, but see, there was four gun outfits in a battery.
Okay,
so I would think probably there must have been four.
And
35, 40 men, something like that.
Okay.
And
so you put it down. Do you have any trouble getting that gun off and the truck and so forth?
No, we didn't have any trouble. But you see, at that time, I think they had cables, and they were pulling, helping pull those trucks up the hill.
So you have a steep hill to go.
Yeah,
up?
You had a steep hill to go up, and of course, you know,
you're in sand.
You'd
yeah,
make deep routes.
Oh yeah, you had a terrible time.
And you had a terrible time getting up there.
Yeah.
But I think that. Probably they had bulldozers with cables helping you along.
Right.
Of course, you had four-wheel drive, but...
Still, you're in sand. And
you had front-wheel drive and the two tandems behind you, so you had a lot of help.
Turn tape now.
End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
Okay, so you're basically, your truck is up there, you're on the beach.
Yeah.
You're hearing all this noise around you. And what's your job now then?
Well, our job was to get them in place as quickly as possible.
So how far from the water's edge did you have to get them in place? Were you have to go inland a mile or so? Or?
Yeah, well, we went in maybe a mile.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not over half a mile.
Uh-huh.
But
then did you set up your units then?
Yeah, we set up the units, and of course, they were... the aircraft, German aircraft, was coming in on us at night there. So at night, you've seen this on TV, Desert Sand. Did you see any of that?
Desert Storm?
The Desert Storm, I mean, Storm.
Yeah.
The skies was absolutely brilliant. I mean, just bright as it could be. And you would be shooting at airplanes, and man, it was something. It was really something. You'd lay down on the ground, and your flashes would just be, it'd just be white all around you. You know, it'd be just like the peak of fireworks down here at the schoolhouse at the 4th of July. It was frightening time, I tell you it was. The thing that I remember about that most is that, and you could just about see where the front lines were. In fact, they told us that they were going to call in the Air Force to bomb on back. And we hadn't got to St. Lo yet. And I can't remember the little town that we were at. But anyway, they were going to call in the Air Force to bomb back behind the lines. And so they put out smoke pots. And they put out them smoke pots. And whenever they called the Air Force in, well, the Air Force came in, but the smoke pot, the wind had changed, and it blowing the smoke back on our troops. So we were bumming our own troops. And that's where General McNair, he got killed. In fact, he was up on the front line, and we wasn't over a half a mile from that at that time. And that smoke blowed back on our troops, and I don't know how many people got killed, but there was a lot of people got killed. We had to move out, so we didn't have time to dwell on nothing like that. They wouldn't let us dwell on.
So, you fired your 40 millimeter then quite a bit?
Oh, right, quite a bit on the beach.
Now, what was
40s
your,
and 90s.
And what was your responsibility with that 40 millimeter?
Well, I was, sometimes I was the ammunition
carrier or whatever.
Yeah, depot ammunition man, to have the ammunition there.
Uh-huh, okay.
No, I didn't actually put it in the gun or anything like that, but I was responsible for having the ammunition at the gun if I was assigned to that battery at that time.
Uh-huh.
Now, if I was assigned to headquarters battery, distributing rations to every battery, then I would be doing that.
Yeah. So what was your primary responsibility? Was it headquarters, or were you actually out in the field with that gun?
Oh, well.
Or did it vary from time to time?
It varied from time to time, and whatever they assigned us to, that's what we did.
Uh-huh. So did you have occasion then to shoot at these German aircraft then quite a bit?
Oh, yeah, on the beach, a lot. In fact, they fired about every night.
What's the noise factor when you're firing those guns? Did you have anything to protect your ears?
No.
Did you? It had to be very loud, I know.
Yeah, well, now the gun, the gun sergeant, he probably did.
Uh-huh.
He probably had something. He would be the one to fire the gun, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, and I don't remember if he had ear protection or not, to tell you the truth. But I never did have any. A lot of the other guys didn't have any.
So when you landed on the beach and got a mile inland, you didn't run into any problems getting in there from a standpoint of any enemy action, did you?
No, we didn't have any enemy action until we got set up. And then after we got set up, then we started having some, probably some tanks to be throwing some of them 88s at us or something.
Did you
like
have
that.
Any any weapons that fired and hit close to you, or were they shooting at you at that time, or were the Germans kind of in retreat? Or
well, they were on the run.
Yeah,
the Germans was on the run, but no, you didn't have a whole lot of incoming fire.
Uh-huh.
Not at that time. They were on the run.
Yeah,
and
so you had to move to keep up, I
guess. Yeah, we had to move to keep up with them. We'd get set up one day, and then maybe the next day we'd have to go somewhere else and set up.
Yeah. And how did you get your message on that? Did you have somebody that came by and told your group?
They had radios, and of course you'd have the all the commanding officers was on
right
the
there.
Beach. Yes, sir.
They were right there with you.
Yes, sir.
They had their meetings, I guess, and then passed on the information.
Passed it right on down to us. Yeah.
So okay,
what to do?
What? So you got set up your first time, then you had to move again. And what was your target? What was your objective, I should say?
Well, our objective was firing at night, and of course, if there's any air raids or anything like that in the daytime, then we would fire. But they was firing all the time. But now they did set us up there one time, and we were shooting those 90s over into these targets. They had these here radar things with them, you know. The 40s was mostly they had a radar, but it wasn't as elaborate as the 90s. But the 90s could be used as field artillery. So they had us set up there at one time where probably I don't know where we're shooting at, on beyond St. Lo, I would think.
What kind of ammunition were you using at that time? All fragmentation type things that would explode and throw out a lot of flak and this kind of thing? Or were you shooting, as 40s would be an actual bullet, right?
Yeah, well, no, 40s would splatter.
They explode too?
Yeah, okay. The 90s would splatter.
Okay, yeah. Both of them splatter.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, and of course the Germans had that too.
Yeah.
But anyway, we got on past St. Lo. In fact, my friend, he got wounded at St. Lo, and they sent him back home.
Uh-huh.
But we went on through St. Lo, went on up.
Did you have any problems in St. Lo particularly, or were you kind of following?
No, we were back. Oh, behind the infantry and the tanks at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we went on up to, I don't know the names of the towns in between there and Paris, but we kept on going until we got to Paris, and we got set up right outside of Paris.
Paris been liberated?
St. Mary Glace.
Yes, St. Mary Glace. Uh-huh.
Something like that.
Had Paris been liberated at this time yet? Or?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was being liberated at that time.
The fighting was still going on.
Yeah, it was being liberated at that time. In fact, the Germans had already gone, and we were going through the towns.
Mopping up or whatever.
Mopping up.
If there was anybody.
And all the people were just all over us, you
ecstatic.
Know, all over the trucks and tanks and everything.
So did you go into town then when the people were lined up on the streets and so forth?
Oh, yeah.
Part of that?
Yeah. We had.
So you went in?
We didn't have a whole lot of that, but we had some of it.
Because you came in a little later, I guess, huh?
Well, yeah. We did in Paris, because we pulled up before we got to Paris in a staging area to kind of rest up, you know, for a minute.
And other people went in,
yeah,
earlier.
That's right.
You did.
And then a few days, then we went on through Paris.
But there were still people and hanging on you. And
oh, yeah, they were just glad to see you and all that kind of stuff, yeah.
So did you stay in Paris long, or did you just
No, we just went right through. We
okay.
went right on through Paris, and I don't know what the next town was after Paris, stayed uh-huh. through.
So what was the combat situation at that time? Were the Germans, again, had they Was there much resistance, or were you kind of keeping them on the run at that?
No, there was a lot of resistance. You'd find some snipers once in a while.
Uh-huh.
And of course, our half tracks with the M51 mounts on them, you know, they would find them in church steeples and everywhere.
Uh-huh.
They'd be shooting at us, you know, and stuff like that. But we didn't have a lot of that around Paris.
Now, your responsibilities at this time, you were still either with your weapon or else you were driving and driving people around, whatever.
That's right. At that time, well,
did you spend most of your time driving people around, or were you most of the time with your weapon, you know, firing your...
Both.
Supporting.
Both. I was, whatever they called me to do, that's what I did.
Okay.
And sometimes if they needed a spare part or something like that, then I'd be sent back. And but I can't remember now where we went on to the Red Ball Highway. I don't remember whether it was after Paris or before Paris.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like to me it was after Paris.
Oh, I think it is after Paris.
Yeah.
Red Ball Express went right into Germany, I think.
Yeah, we went all the way up through Belgium, Germany. So
kind of follow your activities then. Once you left Paris, this would have been, July, I guess, or July of 44 or something, August, something like that. It would have been about that time.
Yeah, I guess.
So then you continued on, your artillery group then continued on. Where did you head for? Did you go into Belgium or did you stay in France? Or do you recall where you kind of went?
No, I remember we went through Cologne.
That's in Germany, of course.
Yeah, but I was trying to think where the other places in France, but I can't remember.
Yeah,
I know we went to Antwerp,
mm-hmm. Belgium.
Belgium,
mm-hmm.
And then from there we went from Antwerp to Liège,
mm-hmm.
And
you were always kind of following up the infantry, I guess, always a little ways back, I guess, for the most part, were you not?
Just a little ways. Now, when we got to Liège, there was another little town up there called St. Tron. Well, they had an air base there.
The Germans had an air base there?
Yeah, no, we had an air
base. Oh, you had an air base.
Well, that might have been the Germans before we got there, yeah, but anyway, we set up around that air base.
That air base.
Yeah, that was pretty close to the Siegfried Line.
Uh-huh.
The Siegfried Line was on over at Maastricht, Holland, between Maastricht and Aachen. That uh-huh. was the Siegfried Line. So we were back this way probably 10 miles.
Did you find much enemy activity there around that air base when you were set up?
Yeah, we had a lot of activity there. In fact, we shot down five German planes there at that place.
Trying to knock out that air base, or at least?
No, they would attack, they attacked us.
Oh, okay.
And they were trying to knock us out. And they had got a direct hit on one of our gun positions, but it didn't kill this boy, the gunman. It didn't kill him. He was in the turret, but it didn't kill him. But it hurt him, but kind of glanced off.
Uh-huh.
The shell did. But the Focke-Wulf 190s. I believe there were two of them. There were two Messerschmitt
109s,
and There was one other, and I can't remember.
A 110 or a Stuka? Dive bomber or whatever?
No, I don't know. I don't remember what it was. But anyway, we got five of them out of that one raid. Now, there was a lot of
them. Your battery?
Uh-huh. And we got one of them, and he jumped out and parachuted himself in. And I really don't know what happened to him.
But so how long were you around that airbase then? Were there quite a while or several weeks? Or?
Several weeks. Probably three.
So was your routine, you were on duty 24 hours a day there.
Right? Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were on.
Did you man your weapon 24 hours a day then?
Yeah, there was somebody out 24 there. Hours a day. Exactly.
There was somebody out there. So you were like, what, on eight, off eight?
Well, I wasn't.
You were.
But the gun crews were.
Uh-huh.
See, I never was on a gun crew.
Yeah.
Directly. On
yeah,
a gun
you were
crew.
Bringing the supply
yeah.
guy.
And supplies and stuff like that in, but I never was on a
what
gun
kind crew. Of, well, you were there now, what kind of facilities were you in a tent, or what did you operate out of at that time? Did they have some barracks there for you?
No, they were some barracks there, and we were in a, our section was in a garage, like a kind of like a garage apartment or a garage barn or
yeah.
something like that, you know.
Yeah.
And so we got set up in that. And
what kind of food did you? I mean, did you eat K rations or what did you?
No. The mess sergeant he would get set up out there, you know, and start cooking this food and everything. And of course, some of the guys in the maintenance and motor pool section, they'd start making showers out of these old
55-gallon.
These old gas tanks that the Germans had, you know, they put on the planes.
Okay.
They're making showers out of them, and something real bad happened to us there when we were at St. Tron. This guy was making, in fact, I had just come off of the Red Ball Highway, and we'd been on that for a week, and we just come in, and this guy was named Sergeant Nettle, I believe that was his name. And he was always doing things for the guys, you know, making showers and trying to get things set up, you know. So he was out there welding on one of those gas tanks, and it blew that way.
Ooh, still had fumes and so forth in it?
Yeah.
Or gas in it?
Yeah.
Or?
Killed him, just dead. Killed him.
Gee whiz.
Blow him up against the brick building.
Hmm.
And he was the nicest guy you've ever seen. He'd just do anything for anybody. You ask him for a thimble, he'd have a thimble. He was just an all-around good guy. And I think he was from Maryland. I don't remember for sure, but I believe he was from Maryland. But anyway, we got set up there, and set up pretty good.
Sounds like it was reasonably comfortable.
Well, we had these fold-out beds, you know, cots.
Yeah.
And we'd spread our
sleeping
bags on right. that thing right there and crawl in there. We'd make out fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the most thrilled action that we had was when we was flying on those airplanes, and I don't know why we didn't get a medal for that, but we didn't. We didn't ever get one. We did get the French Breguet. You know, that thing, the rope that you go around your, we got that. And so from there, We stayed around around Liege for a while. And Liege is the where the Browning shotgun was made.
Oh.
The Browning shotgun factory was in Liege.
I see.
I never did get a chance to go down and go through it. But from Liege, we went on across over to Maastricht, Holland. And then right after Maastricht, we crossed over the Siegfried Line, and they had already bombed Aachen and tore up Aachen terrible, just leveled it, just leveled it down.
Did you see any German resistance as you were traveling up to Maastricht and over to Aachen, or was there any resistance at that point that you had to?
Not a lot. There was some, but not a lot. They had already pushed them on back, and the bomb, you know, when they bombed the city there, well, they left. But anyway, we come back out of there, come back down to Liege.
You mean you went from Aachen back to?
Yeah, we came back to Maastricht, came down to Liege, and went on down to a little old town called the Gavette. And this was when we were going to Bastogne, on our way to Bastogne.
Okay.
And then we went over and set up across the river
from
Gavette. Part of our outfit went down to Namur. It was a little town on down the river. And went across over there. And we were set up across the ridge there, firing over into there. So
there were still pockets of resistance?
Oh, yeah, there were pockets of resistance everywhere.
But there weren't any big massed armies, were they, from the German? There weren't huge numbers of them, were there?
Well, huge numbers of them, but we got set up there up on the hill, and whenever you go down through Gavette, you had to go down and go up beside the river and go up through the rocks and go on up to the top and get on up there. So the river was really a gorge. I mean, it was just way down here in the mountains on both sides. We got set up there, and so they launched an attack on us. They told us to get out from up there, get back down that mountain.
Who told you this?
Our people.
Yeah, said to get down.
That they were coming in on us. They said, get out, leave your guns where they are, leave everything alone. So we rushed up there and took the trucks up there and said, we're not taking the guns. And so the old gun sergeant said, yes, we are. We're going to take that gun. We jerked that gun out of that hole and hooked it up that truck. I bet you it didn't take us 15 minutes. And we pulled that gun out and on the road. And when we pulled it out on the road, the Panzer tanks was already trying to get in position to shoot, to fire. And we went down that mountain with that 90 millimeter gun now. And that truck was backfiring, man. I mean, we went down there just like that. All the way down. And I pulled that thing across the river, across the bridge, and over there, and there's houses up and down here. And I pulled it behind these houses. And they started throwing them 88s in there on us.
How close were those tanks to you at that point?
I'd say they wasn't any farther than, the entrance out yonder, if they were that far.
Oh, it's less than about an eighth of a mile or less.
Yeah, you could see them. You could see them getting around and trying to get into position to fire.
So the tanks were shooting at your group, or were you hidden behind these buildings?
No, we were going down that hill. I mean, we were pulling out.
Okay.
Recruiting, you know.
Yeah.
And we got down there, and so they started throwing them 88s in on us. And of course, this hill up here was all rock.
Uh-huh.
It was all rock. They'd throw them things in there, and they'd scream, you know, and then it'd splatter all over everything. And we got under this road cover. This road cover was probably that big, 48 inches probably.
And you got out of your truck and you hid, is that the idea?
Yeah, we pulled behind these buildings.
Yeah, you pulled behind and left your equipment there.
Oh, well, they were right there, right over there is the...
tank?
No, underneath the road.
Uh-huh. Where you hid, okay.
Yeah. And so we stayed there.
Let me understand. You got out of your tank. You left the gun parked up there, and then you went over to the culvert. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Well, right along here is the road,
uh-huh.
And here's the row of houses.
Okay.
So we pulled up here.
Yeah.
Went down and got in that road covered.
Okay.
So that shrapnel wouldn't
right.
hit us. You know?
Okay. How many people were in that little culvert there?
Probably 8 of us.
And barely room to for all of you to get in.
Oh yeah, but
squeezed in there.
But we could, you know, we were kind of sheltered a little bit there, and so we could get out and in and stuff like that. That's where we had our Christmas dinner.
Now, how long did you stay in
Thanksgiving
that?
Dinner?
How long did you stay in the culvert?
Oh, one night.
Now, didn't the German tanks keep it coming at you?
Well, they were shooting over the top of us. They were
okay.
shooting over there on the hill. You know, they were lobbing those 88s over the hill there.
Uh-huh.
See, this was a high hill.
What were they shooting at up there? Was there something else up there?
Shooting at us. They knew that we were down there. Well, they knew we were over there.
But they were. But they weren't shooting right at you. They were shooting up in this hill. Or?
Well, they're shooting up. Hoping it'd fall down on you, you know.
Okay, so
yeah.
this kind of
lob over you.
Oh, they were lobbing it over, hoping it could, you know, lob and just bring it right in on top of you.
A few days, I think it was probably a couple of days, the English was on our left flank. And so they were coming up the river. And they were going across the bridge and going up to the left,
mm-hmm.
that way. Well, we were going up to the right. So we told them, whenever they pulled up there, that the Germans had been firing those 88s in there on them, and said, they didn't care, you know. So they went on across. About the time they got about the middle of the bridge, boy, one of those 88s hit them direct.
Oh, no kidding. Wiped them out.
No, just knocked that one tank out or truck or whatever it was.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember now what it was. I think it was a truck, though.
Uh-huh.
And so they finally got that off of the bridge, and then they kept going. And they'd go up that way, and about the time they'd get up about to the top of the thing, they were about the top of the hill over there, they'd stop and have a spot of tea.
They actually did that.
Actually did that in combat. Of course, they were, you know, right beside of the hill, and they were lobbing them over this way, so there wasn't much of a way they was going to hit them. They actually stopped and got a spot of tea.
Unbelievable.
It is. It was unbelievable. We couldn't believe it.
Tell me about your Thanksgiving dinner.
I don't remember a lot about
it. No, you said you were under the cupboard. You know.
Well, we were under that cupboard.
Uh-huh.
The truck came along, you know, and gave us... they had it served out, you know, and they, like, you'd go down here and you'd get something that they'd have it in those cartons and then dole it out to you. Sometimes they'd have it that way, and sometimes you'd have to take your mess kit up there and dip out what you wanted.
How did they even know you were there? I mean,
Well, I guess maybe they were just strung out everywhere, and they would just go around trying to find anybody. Yeah.
Well, it's a wonder they didn't get, they probably did get shot at, I suppose. Too.
Well, I don't know if they got shot at or not. I think maybe they might have got some of that shrapnel, but at night, it was terrifying to hear those screaming memes. That's what they call them, screaming memes. Coming in and they'd splatter all over that hill up there, and it was scary. It really was. But you didn't stay scared all the time. You got up some more nerve the next day. You had to do your job. Yeah, you got up some more nerve the next day and kept it going.
So what happened to you then? That you got out of the culvert?
Well, I think they did strafe them or bum them or something like that over there.
So our planes kind of took those tanks out or whatever.
And we went on back over the hill again. So we went on back up and over the hill and started on towards Bastogne. And
this was before the Battle of the Bulge actually started,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was the beginning of the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah, that offensive where the German Panzers were, yeah, was the beginning of it, huh?
That was the beginning of the battle.
So, okay, so that was, okay.
Now, Adams was, he was in a tank outfit, uh-huh, and he was along up in there somewhere.
So you're heading toward Bastogne.
Yeah, and I might be getting my cart before the horse, but the Ardennes Forest was in that area somewhere.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And
absolutely.
So we got into that Ardennes Forest, and they were throwing those shells in there. And you'd look out through the clearing out there, and you'd just be smoking those phosphor shells. And they'd just be smoking all out through there. And so that's whenever all the Germans started surrendering and coming in, you know. And we got trapped up there some way or another. But it didn't last.
Your unit got trapped?
All of us got trapped, uh-huh, in there. In that, I don't know whether it was in the Ardennes Forest or whether it was a little bit on past that. But I wished I could be more clear about this thing. But it's so vague now that I remember that, I mean, lines and lines of those Germans would be surrendering and coming on back.
What'd they look like?
Oh, they were in uniform and had their helmets on.
Were they bedraggled looking or beaten looking?
A lot of them need shave and stuff like that. No, I wasn't there. Very humble, nice. You didn't have any problem with them fussing at you or cussing you or anything like that. Humble people. Germans are good people. I like them. I really like them. I think they're smart people. But, you know, we didn't know anything about them at that time. But later on, we got to know some of the people, and they were nice people. They were victims of circumstances.
So you were there. Were you anywhere near where the Germans' point of attack was in the Battle of the Bulge? You were fairly near, but you weren't really affected by it personally, in the sense that you weren't ambushed or anything of that nature by their attacking forces
We were surrounded. I think that we were surrounded, but and I can't think whether it was the 82nd Airborne or the 82nd
How did you
tank outfit?
I mean, you went.
We didn't even know it.
You didn't even know you
we
were surrounded.
We didn't know we were surrounded at that time.
Right.
But they came in and.
So fast.
So fast. And we had to get down and dig our foxholes that night.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we actually.
You knew there was
got
a lot. There was a lot of fire going on around
you. Yeah,
the fire
there was a lot of fire going on, and we had to get down and dig those foxholes that night because they said that they were probably going to attack us that night. And they did throw some shells in our area, but not anything that I was just real lucky. I didn't get hurt. I didn't get hit. I didn't get.
But you were under fire, though.
Oh yeah, I was under fire. That's and in fact, if you're not in the battle zone, I don't think you'd have got the medal.
Yeah, right.
If you wasn't in that battle zone, you know.
Right.
But.
So how long were you under fire then, Jimmy? Was this a period of several days or?
3 days, I believe.
3 days.
I believe it was 3 days. We was in there.
And then is that when you started seeing the Germans surrendering? Or?
Yeah, they started surrendering. In fact, they was on the way to. I can't remember that little town up there, but it was near Bastogne, and they started shoving them back. So we had to guard them to a certain point, and then somebody else would take them on to a certain point, you know, and. Place where they
could. Did you have enough guys where you could even guard? How do you guard that many
people?
Well,
didn't take no guards. You just walk along. They didn't try to do anything. They would have their white things, you know, holding up their white things.
Of course, somebody had already stripped them of all.
Sure, they stripped them of all their guns and all the ammunition. They were just as helpless as you and I sitting here. But they never caused any trouble. They didn't have no trouble out of them at all.
Uh-huh.
But
what age were they? Do you recollect? Were there a lot of young people?
I'd say that that most of them was probably from 19 to 45.
Mm-hmm.
All ages.
Did you notice any real young ones, for example? I mean, any that you recognize?
Yeah, there was some young ones in there, but I didn't bother to either recognize it. Tell you the truth.
Yeah.
We were on our way going, and we wanted them to get on. Back out of the way so we could go.
So they were clogging up the road, I guess.
Yeah, they were clogging up the road, and it was.
What did you hear about McAuliffe and Bastogne? Did you hear about his famous nuts? You know, when they asked him to surrender, and he said nuts. You know.
Well, I remember a little something about that, but I didn't have access to that kind
information.
Of information. No.
Did you have any communications from a standpoint of did you get Stars and Stripes ever when you were going through this whole thing?
Yeah, we got Stars and Stripes at different times.
Uh-huh.
You know,
you kind of caught up every now and then. With
yeah, some of the and issues. we get Stars and Stripes then, but
you didn't see it. Too often, though.
No, not very often. No.
Yeah. Okay. So after Bastogne and the Battle of the Bulge, then where were you headed then?
We went on to in Bastogne, or going on to Bastogne. The 7th Army was on our left-hand side. And I think that that's what Adams was attached to, the 7th Army.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, the English and the Canadians was on their flank.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the 2nd Armored Division and all those guys was on our right, and I don't remember now what the name of their 9th Army, maybe, 7th Army, and we were attached to the 7th Army part of the time. We were attached to the 9th Army part of the time. And so we were just thrown around like a baseball most all the time.
Do you recall who some of your commanding generals were at that time?
Well, Patton was, he was the chief huncho, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess.
End of tape A, side two. The interview continues on tape B, side one.
Well,
that was sometime after, though, wasn't it? Or?
Yeah, that was sometime after. Okay. But well, you asked me where we were headed after that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, we went on up to, and there again, I can't remember the town, but we were on our way to the Elbe River.
Elbe River.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we were...
Meet the Russians.
Yeah, to meet the Russians. So we went up to about 3 miles back this side of the Elbe River, and I can't remember the name of the town, but I do remember this much, that Eisenhower asked the Germans to surrender so that he wouldn't have to tear up this town. He says, I do not want to tear up this town, but he says, if you'll go ahead and surrender, and we won't tear up this town. But they would not surrender. They would just kept on and on and on, and we tore that thing into ashes. And I can't remember the name of the town, but it was about 3 miles back this side of the Elbe River. And some of our guys went up to the Elbe River, and I went up there, but it was already dark and I couldn't see anything. But they went up there the next day, and these old Russian tanks was on the other side of the river, you know, and they said that these hatches would fly open, these big old women would come out of them tanks, you know.
Women?
Women driving them tanks. And as I say, I did not see that myself, but we went up to the Elbe River that evening, and it was dark, and we didn't see anything, but the war was already declared over, and but they had all their tanks and all that kind of stuff over there. But, and then we, after that, we bivouac or pulled into a bivouac area over there around this air base. You never seen it the like of German planes. I mean, nice planes, really nice planes. We went over there and we went through hangars and went into those airplanes, you know, and we're just really nice airplanes, just did not have no fuel to run them. And do you know that the United States gave Russia every bit of that stuff off of that airfield? And they were some nice stuff, and a lot of it that the United States gave Russia, and they came in there and hauled it off with these big, long trailers. Take those wings off them airplanes, take them right on back.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, we went to, but on our way up to Bastogne, we came by this place where the submarines, and it was a place that you could see on a fair day across to Denmark. And they had submarine base up there, And they had tunnels that they could put them submarines in. And they had a, we run across a storage place up there where they had a lot of guns and ammunition and all that kind of stuff stored. And we would take cases of Lugers and P-38 pistols and take them back and give them to our friends, you know, and stuff like that. In fact, I had a brand new P-38 and I had a brand new Luger. I still got the Luger somewhere, but I don't know whatever happened to a P-38. I lost it, or I don't know what happened to it. But I brought back a P-38 and I brought back a Luger. In fact, I had the Luger hid, I mean the P-38 hid in my duffel bag. And they got the Luger on my discharge.
Oh.
Yeah. They got the Luger on the discharge. So
you were authorized to take that Luger,
huh? Yeah, I'll see that right there.
Okay, I'm looking at Jimmy's discharge here.
Yeah, let's see. Is that Luger?
Yeah. For heaven's sake.
As I say, I don't know whatever happened to my P-38. It might have got misplaced when we got off the ship. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So when you met the Russians at the Elbe River, then the war, Germany had not formally surrendered at that time, had they? I don't think they had they? It was a few days after that, as I remember.
Yeah, I think it was a few days after that. In fact, I remember that we were alongside the road in a convoy,
mm-hmm.
moving on up. And that was when we got the word that the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
That was after that the town that I told you about was bombed and everything.
Oh, just shortly before the war was over, this town was wiped out,
yep.
because the Germans wouldn't surrender.
Yeah, tried to get them to surrender, and they wouldn't do it. So they just made it just like a bed of ashes.
Mm.
Pretty town, real pretty town. They said it was a nice town.
Pitiful.
And they did.
So how long did you stay then after Germany actually surrendered? Then what happened to you?
Well, we
you were in the Elbe River area, I guess, at some point. And then
no, we came back down some ways, and I can't remember where we went up to that. We were bivouacked pretty close to that submarine base. And I can't, some Barry, not Newberry, but anyway, it was something like that. But we stayed around in that area for a week or so, and then they started, we thought we were going to go to Italy after the war. So we kept on waiting around, and then finally decided that they wasn't going to take us. So they sent us down to debarkation area, Lucky Strike.
Mm-hmm. Camp Lucky Strike. Yeah.
Camp Lucky Strike.
Now, did you know how many points you had at this time, and they were counting points up and everything?
I had enough points.
They'd already publicized how many points you need to get out and what have you.
Yeah. Yeah.
This all happened pretty fast, I guess, right after the war.
It did, and you know, right now I can't remember how many points I suppose I had. But I had enough points because I had five battle stars.
Yeah.
And so I had enough points to get out, and we went on down to Lucky Strike and stayed down there for several weeks.
Uh-huh.
And before we could ever get a ship back. And so finally we did get a ship, went into Le Havre, and shipped out of Le Havre and came back to New York.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where in the world did I go after New York? I don't know.
But you were on your way out, and you went to some point where they officially discharged you, I guess, huh?
I don't know if we went back over to Camp Shanks or not.
Uh-huh.
But it kind of seemed like we did. We come into the affair one night on the ship, and I think they took us all the way over to Camp Shanks that night, and then they shipped us right on back down to Fort Bragg.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you were discharged from Fort Bragg?
Fort Bragg was where I was discharged from.
And, of course, you hadn't been home for a couple of years, I guess.
Yeah. See, we was all there
time,
2 years.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Long time.
Yeah.
So how did you get home? Did you take a bus home, or how did you recall? Did you have some of your family pick you up? But probably took a bus, I suppose.
I don't remember.
Well, and you went back to Ashboro, of course.
Yeah, I went back to Ashboro.
What was it like when you got back home?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. Yes, sir. Everybody was glad to see us. It was absolutely wonderful, I tell you, it was.
Did many of your friends that you went in with get out alive?
Yeah. Two of the boys that I went to school with, the one that got wounded St. Lo, and then the other, he was in, I can't remember if he was in the infantry or the artillery, but one or the other. But the boy that got wounded, he was in the infantry. But I think this other boy was in the artillery, or half tracks or something like that. But it was quite an experience.
I'm sure it was.
But I'm thankful that I got out of it, you know, alive and well and no scars. No.
You didn't have any injuries at all?
No injuries at all. The only thing that I had while I was in service was they lanced my tooth.
That place.
I abscessed too.
Okay. Let's ask a couple questions here about some just kind of general questions of interest. The when you were fighting, and you know, after you landed on after D-Day particularly, how well did the supply system keep up with your needs?
Pretty doggone good. Really did.
You didn't run out of things?
Well, you probably didn't have some of the things that you'd like to eat, but when we were on Normandy, a lot of times what you eat didn't satisfy you, you know, and it wasn't enough. So we'd maybe steal us a gallon of fruit cocktail and go out there and eat it in our pup tents at night on the beach. And That really helped out too, I'll tell you did. But it was.
Did you have anybody that you were associated with in your group who was kind of who had the ability to get things when people needed them? You know, you're always some guy who's able to get things when nobody else can.
I had some real close buddies. Fred T. Bowman, he was about the same caliber guy that I was, and Fred and I palled around a lot together, and he was clerk, I believe, battery clerk. And then, of course, this Faust boy from up in Amish country, he was over the supply, and we would get him to go in and get us a can of fruit cocktail.
So that was your man, huh?
Yeah, that was my man. And, and of course, we had several other boys that, you know, could go in the kitchen and get us stuff at night, and as long as old mess sergeant didn't see, you know. And, if there was anything left over, we could go in there and get it. They didn't throw it away right then. Usually kept it probably the next morning. And but we got along pretty good with our eating and stuff like that. We didn't.
Did you eat a lot of K rations or C rations?
We did at times. At times we.
What'd you think about those?
Wasn't too bad.
How about those D bars? You ever heard of those D bars?
Yeah, we had those in our duffel bag all the time. We kept those all the time.
Were they edible? I mean,
yeah, they were edible, and I'll tell you, they would hold you. They would hold you for a while. They really would.
They're kind of like chocolate, weren't they?
But yeah, kind of really like these bars that you get at school sales, you know. These long bars.
Yeah, like right.
About like that. Of course, you had C rations all the time. You could open up your can of C rations, and either vegetable stew or something like that.
Now, how were you dressed in combat? What did you wear?
What
did you carry?
Fatigues. I carried fatigues, and of course, I had that little old thing you put on your back, and. Part of the time I carried a carbine, and part of the time I carried a submachine gun, 45.
Now, but, you have to carry a lot of ammunition to go with that?
Well, you'd have to carry on your belt. You'd have a belt of ammunition. And sometimes you'd have it stuck down in your vest, you know.
Did you ever have to fire any of those weapons?
Yeah, we fired some up when we were in the Arden Forest. We fired then. On the submachine guns, that old machine gun, I fired it a lot up there. I don't think I ever hit anybody or hopefully.
But you thought you saw somebody that needed to be hit?
Well, we'd seen some movement and stuff like that, or we would have never fired.
Yeah, right.
But we were at liberty to fire at will. If we seen anything move or anything like that, we didn't hesitate. We were free to fire at will. But I hope I didn't hit nobody. I don't think I did.
How about your leadership, Jimmy, that you had? I mean, you had this. What was your highest ranking officer in your person in your group?
Lieutenant Colonel. Well, in fact, he got to be full colonel before the war was over with. But he was a lieutenant colonel. His name was Colonel Eccles, and he was from in the Philadelphia area. He was a school teacher before he ever got into the army.
Was he well respected? Individual.
Nice guy, just like an old woman. And we had a West Point major, a whole lot smarter than the colonel was. but he was a good guy.
Could you tell the difference in their leadership styles between the two?
Well,
between the colonel and the major?
Well, the major, he was gung-ho. The colonel was kind of a setback old woman, but the major respected his rank, and he didn't overstep his bounds. Yeah. But
the major was a more intense, tougher guy.
Yeah, but a nice guy with it. He was really a nice guy, and you see, we could talk to him. They wasn't mightier than I or higher than I, you can go talk to them and they'd talk to you. Captain Philbrook and Lieutenant, forget that. He was the best guy to me. Ooh, Captain Philbrick and this lieutenant, he was, they were really nice to me. In fact, I got along really good. In fact, they had called me and said, Dave says, want you to carry me to, well, one night we'll carry me to, went into Antwerp and, but I'm not bragging, but I could get around real good over there. I don't know why, but I had a good sense of direction, and I could get along real good. So the captain or the major or colonel, I want you to carry me into Wentworth. And they'd go in, maybe have some people that they wanted to see, and the Belgian people was nice people. In fact, we were up. One night we pulled up into near Antwerp, right there close to it, and this was on a Saturday night. It was beautiful. The weather was just like it is right now. We were out there on and pulled up all up and down the street. And we slept out on the street that night and in our sacks, you know. Next morning, well, there was a lot of these Belgian people going to church. Nice Belgian man and his wife and daughter, beautiful daughter. And of course, you know, that was right up our alley at that time. And they came back after church and says, we could take three of you fellas to dinner if you'd go with us. In broken English, they speak. So we said, we'd love to. And they just lived down the street there, just a little ways. And evidently he was a coal man. You know, they had slack piles over there, tremendous. Went on down below the slack pile after a little ways, and he had his house all went in with this wrought iron fencing, you know, and beautiful house out there. So we went in, and man, they had the best dinner for us. Treat us royally, just treat us royally. And I guess the little girl was, she was probably 16 years old, something like that. And she had a cousin with her. And of course, we all had dinner, and just as nice they could be, and we just thanked them and thanked them and thanked them.
Did you ever see them again?
Never seen them no more.
How about it?
we were on the move all the time.
Yeah. How was the discipline in your group that you observed among the men?
Very good. Very good. We
didn't have any wild people that wanted to do their own thing in this country.
Nobody was wild. We'd get wild at night talking, fighting the.
Fighting the Germans,
the fighting the Civil War.
Oh, fighting the Civil War, okay.
Oh, man, we'd have a good time. We'd argue, you know, and argue and argue and argue. They'd say this about us, you know, and we'd say that about them, you know. But we had a good time. We had guys from Philadelphia, New York, Maryland, Delaware. We had people from everywhere. Alabama, Georgia, Florida. We just had a mixture of everybody. And they was Italians, and they was Jews, and they was all kinds of people, Catholics and everything else. But we got along good, didn't have no trouble. I never had any trouble at all, except one night this old boy went out, and we were in Camp Stewart, Georgia. That's where I was trying Savannah, to think of right. A little while ago, in Savannah. This old boy had been out and he got drunk. So I was in the train shaving and cleaning, taking a shower, and getting ready for everything. So he came in and started mouthing off to me, and that was the only time that I ever had any problem. But I did have a little problem with him, but didn't mount a whole lot. But the colonel called me in the next day and says, "Dave," said, "what happened out there last night?" I said, "Well, old Wessinger came in, he's drunk, tried to start a fight with me," and I says, "we just got in a little scrap," but I says, "didn't mount to that." He says, "don't let it happen again."
How about, was there any discrimination that you noticed among your fellows that you were in the service with, particularly?
Well, yeah, and of course, you know, we didn't have blacks,
right?
But there was discrimination among the Jews would look after their kind
mm-hmm.
first.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I had some problems with my teeth about the time I got out, about before we ever broke up our battalion. and the dentist was a Jew. I tried my best to get him to my teeth would just, they would just ache, you know. And so I tried to get him to do something for him, and he never would call me in. And they were discrimination in the top echelon in the headquarters battery, in the administrative section.
That's interesting.
Yeah. There was. In fact, the Jew boys got the best jobs. And I never did have any problem with that. It never did matter to me, you know, at all. But there was some problems. They would bitch about it, but there was anything done about it. So,
any problems with drugs or gambling or people going AWOL, this kind of thing?
No. We I don't know whether we had over one or two people in that whole 3 years that I was in that went AWOL.
Mm-hmm.
We just had a good outfit. I'll tell you, we did. Well, I was very fortunate. And as I say, the officers, all of them was good. We had all the battery commanders was good. They were good to their men. And you could go talk to them, and you could tell them your problems, or just talk to them in general.
Mm-hmm.
They were good guys.
Did you ever have any spare time, particularly in much of your
not a whole lot? Now, at times they could go out on leave maybe at night.
Where would this have been?
The nearest town.
I mean, this was not in Europe. Now you're talking about Europe.
Oh, anywhere.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. If you could get a pass out, like before we were Lee up in St. John, you could get a pass down to Lee Edge.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And you could...
just had to be back.
You just got to be back, yes, sir, by 11 o'clock or something like that, you know, 12 or whatever time they told you.
Yeah.
But we were always being able to get out, but a lot of times I didn't go out... Fred Bowman and I didn't go out a whole lot.
Did you ever have occasion to be helped by the Red Cross or the USO or any of those organizations?
The only time that I had ever had any thing to do with the Red Cross was in Reading, England. We went into Reading. From Thatcham, think it was Thatcham or Newberry won. And I had to find a place to stay, and they found me a place to stay that night. Three of us, mm-hmm. the three boys that left here, they came to see me, and we went up to on pass to, and all I had to do is just go to the captain and ask, tell him. I said, I got my three of my friends here. He says, how about give me a pass tonight? He said, no problem. Give me a pass, and I believe I got a couple of nights up there. And the Red Cross found me a place to stay, but that's the only time I ever come in contact with the Red Cross while I was over there.
Did you ever hear Axis Sally or anybody over the radio?
Oh, yeah. Sure did.
What did you think about that? I mean, what was your impression of her and what she was talking about and so forth?
Well, we thought she was a witch, you know. She wasn't talking our language at all.
Did she play good music? Or?
Yeah, tried to get us on her side, you know, and stuff like that.
Do you recall what she talked about or anything? Did she have any secret information?
She just talked in general, and tell GIs this and GIs that, trying to get them on her side, you know.
Trying to get them worried about what's happened to their girlfriend home.
And that's right. That's right. Don't you want to go back home and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Your girlfriend's getting lonesome and all that kind of stuff. You know?
Did you have any impression of the ability of the German fighting man as you were doing your thing? Did you, in his tactics and organization and how well they did what they were doing?
Well, I thought they were good. And I think that, or I thought then and I think now that they were doing just like we were doing. They were doing what they were told. They wasn't mad at us. And of course, we wasn't mad at them. The only thing, we wanted to get this thing cleared up and get it over with. I mean, and that's, of course, you know, we were going after them. But as a rule, I don't think that the German people as a whole was ever mad at the United States or the American people.
Yeah, their leaders just...
Their leaders led them along. That's exactly what happened.
Did you ever face any SS troops as opposed to the regular German infantrymen or fighting men?
I never, I never did face any of those. I heard about them a lot, but I never did face any of them.
How about the morale of your unit? Did you feel like your men had good morale?
Most of the time. Most of the time.
What would cause you for somebody to be kind of down and so forth?
You sit around and waiting for this and waiting for that, and it kind of gets you wondering what in the world it's like waiting for the D-Day to come around. Well, you get tired.
Gets on your nerves.
Yeah, it gets on your nerves. You knew that something was going to happen and it needed to happen, but it just wouldn't happen. You sit around, you wait.
Starts gnawing at you.
Yeah.
How about mail? Did you get your mail fairly in a reasonable
mail
way?
Mail wasn't too awfully plentiful. Sometimes we'd get a whole bunch of it at a time, and then, of course, we'd go for a long time, and then we wouldn't get any, you know. And then first thing you know, you'd have a whole bunch of mail, and you'd have a box or two, you know. Mama, she'd send me boxes of cookies and stuff like that, you know. And
did you ever find that somebody sampled those cookies before you got them?
No. They come in pretty good shape. Yeah, come in pretty good shape.
How about shell shock or combat fatigue and those kinds of things, as many of your fellows that you were involved with have a problem along those lines?
No, we didn't have any shell shock or anything like that. We did have a lot of guys to get their toes and their ears and fingers just about froze, frostbitten, you know, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. That was when we were on our way to Bastogne. And I was going to tell you a while ago that you'd see cows and horses and stuff like that laying out beside the road, and all blowed up and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Of course, you just keep on going. But there were a lot of that on the road to Bastogne, too.
You said that you had some information about Patton.
Yeah.
When he died. Talk about that.
I can't remember now where we was. Where was Hitler's headquarters?
Birch's Garden?
Yeah, in Birch's Gardens. And what was the name of the town right out close to that?
Do you recall about what you had to say about Patton then?
He was a tough guy. And of course, I never heard him, I never was around him a lot, except for one time. I did hear a little bit of his lecture. He was lecturing a lot of these guys out in the field there. And of course, I just came up on it whenever it was ready to break up. So he just lectured a whole bunch of his, you know, his divisions.
Uh-huh.
It was a bunch of people out there, but Patton was everybody said he was blood and guts, but he was gung ho, man. He was gung ho. He was wanting to move. And of course, he wanted to move at any expense. He didn't care what it was, but he was a good general. But I remember when he got killed, but I can't remember what town it was. We were told several tales about it, but they told us one time that he was in this little town called Mans. And he was coming out of an alley, and somebody run over him with a truck, but that wasn't true. He was at a crossroads out from, and I think it was Nuremberg or somewhere like that. And there was somebody run over him with either a weapons carrier or something.
Uh-huh.
But they had a bad wreck at a crossroads. I know that's where.
Yeah, he was killed in auto accident.
Yeah, right. but he was a good general, but I never had any contact with him.
Right. Okay. How did you learn about Germany surrendering? You were at the Elbe River or near there?
We were near the Elbe River. We were parked alongside the road, and they. Either we got information somewhere or another. I don't know how we got information, uh-huh. but the colonel come and told us that
war was over.
Just halt, stay where you are until we get further information.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, well, we were told that the war was over, and I think the next day or the next day one, well, the war was declared over.
Mm-hmm. How did you learn about VJ Day, victory over Japan? I mean, you were on your way to Italy. I think you said you might have been on your way to Italy or something.
No, we never did get on the way. In fact, I think that we were still at Lucky Strike when we found out about the
VJ Day.
Uh huh.
I see. Okay. have you seen Saving Private Ryan? That movie.
Yeah, I've seen that.
What did you think about that film? Did it kind of
you? It brought back a lot of memories. I tell you, it did. It was a good movie. It really was.
Was it realistic from your standpoint?
Yeah, It really was. It was. I told my wife. I says, "Man, that was just about as real as it could be."
Yeah. Better than most.
I think. Yeah, I think so.
Jim, do you have any particular one thing that you look back upon as being maybe the most memorable of your service career? Is there any particular thing that kind of stands out? Any event?
Well, I think the Battle of the Bulge was probably my worst time that I spent. Of course, when we were on the beach, it was bad, and I guess that was on the beach at St. Tron, Belgium, and the Battle of the Bulge. Those three takes precedent over anything that I ever went through with. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't actually bad for me, but it was bad for the whole thing. It was a bad time. You take those pill boxes on the beaches, they like to never busted those things up. In fact, our mechanized equipment done as much as the bombers did. You know, they started dropping those 500-pound blockbusters in all of those things, and they still couldn't bust them up. Of course, they were about three, 4 foot deep.
Concrete.
Thick, yeah. They were something else.
What do you think about your time in service? What can you characterize your time that you spent? What do you think about what you did back then?
Well, I don't think that I was any different from anybody else. I think that I was just among the many. I don't have any regrets. I don't carry any animosity or you know, I did what I was supposed to do, and I was happy. I was happy when I got out. Still happy.
So, I know you are.
I don't have any regrets at all.
How did it change your life, if you think it did?
Well, I think it opened my eyes a lot. You know, I was just a little old farm boy. 19 years old, wanting to do something, wanting to get into something. So service helped me open my eyes a lot to the workings of the world, you know. And whenever I got back, well, I think that it broadened my vision of things. And I don't think that military service hurt me in any way. If anything, it helped me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like I say, I was just a ordinary person trying to do something. I was young, energetic, and wanting to do something. But and after I got out of service, I went back to the mill for a while, but then I got tired of that, and I came to Eden and went into the small loan business.
Oh, small loan business first, yeah, okay.
I stayed in the small loan business about 7 years, and then I tried to get into the hardware business.
Yeah, and then you ran your hardware business for
38 years.
Uh-huh.
And
it's still running down there under other management.
No. Closed it out completely.
Well, you closed it out completely. Okay.
And Jones Hardware is still down there, but Leakesville Hardware, I closed it out.
Leakesville Hardware closed out. Okay, anything else you'd like to add, Jimmy, to our conversation about your experiences some 55, 58 years ago?
No, I don't have anything else to add. I'm just thankful that I'm still able to get around and do. And a lot of people my age, you know, that served in the service is not maybe as physically shaped that I'm in, and I'm thankful for that. I don't have any regrets at all.
Okay, with that final comment, we will conclude our interview with Mr. Jimmy Davidson. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.